Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jeffrey Wright and Company. My name is Jeffrey Wright. I am your host. As always, you can listen to us on the radio dial 92.9 FM, 680 AM. But now we are streaming live on YouTube, Twitch, as well as X, the Everything app. Just go find the 92.9 ESPN accounts, and we are streaming there live. George Ruggiero is the producer of the program. You can follow him on the Everything app at KingGeorge94. George, good day, sir.
Good afternoon, sir. Happy Festivus.
Happy Festivus for the rest of us. A lot of complaints, and you people are going to hear about it. We also have over on ESPN, I think Toledo just tried to run a fake punt on 4th and 23? Did I get that right? Was that a...
Maybe. Was there a penalty call?
Oh, no. They had the graphics wrong. It was third down because of a penalty. I was like, that was a long way to fake a punt. My company, he's joining me on a Tuesday. Tim's had some travel problems, so Cobb's stepping in. No Cobb this week, obviously, because Thursday is Christmas. Cobb, good day, sir.
Hey, good day. Merry Christmas to you guys. You looking forward to the big day?
So I went and did some minimal shopping today.
You're just now getting.
Oh, Cobb, I'm a December 24th guy. I'm ahead of the game.
How does that work out for you?
You know what? It's one of those situations that it's now actually come back around into my benefit. I think people have freaked themselves out so much about having to go and shop on the day before the day, you know, the 23rd, the 24th. It really wasn't that bad. And I even went to Germantown Parkway.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
And I went to the Walmart.
Oh, wow.
That one right there on stage. Yeah, the one right across from Wolf Chase.
Oh, you went to that. That's the Walmart I went to growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good, solid Walmart. I can't say enough good things. Underrated Sam's Club next to it. But
got the Lowe's right there down the street.
Yeah, and I went in, found what I needed, went to the self-check, and I was like in and out.
Could have gone and played nine at what was formerly known as Stonebridge.
Oh, yeah. They've renamed it.
Was it Lakeland Golf Course?
Maybe
now?
That's it. Yeah, because somebody was like, what is Lakeland Golf Course? And I was like, I think there was like the brothers, maybe there was a dispute of the family ownership. Like, you know.
You keep going down 64. You remember there used to be that easy paintball shop.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I used to love going
Challenge
to that
Park.
Place. Nothing more fun than buying 500 brand new paintballs.
Well, we were laughing yesterday. I was somehow, what was the, so I've always thought the two coolest paintball guns, the guys that had the Tiger Splash autocockers.
Those... Oh, I just had a semi-automatic Spider.
Yeah, I had the same, Spider 2000. Like, oh yeah. It was like it was enough to where your parents didn't feel cheap, but they were not spending more than like $120 on a gun. Yeah.
It was always hard, though, when your opponents had these AI tips and customs.
The Angel, was that the one that was just like literally they just had a paintball machine gun?
I had a couple of buddies who would get these paintball catalogs and like order their guns from
the hopper the hopper that would like spin itself.
Oh, it's insane. If I tried to fire more than like five shots in 30 seconds, my hopper would clog, you know?
Oh, and then the guys that would cheat. And remember like when you had to go and fire your gun before the match? Like they put you on the radar gun? To make sure that it wasn't too high, and then the guys that would always bring their own tool and then crank it back. Like, they would fire their gun to get it under the limit. Like, they were the original Tom Brady. Like, they were
inflating. So much cheating.
Yeah,
so much cheating.
deflating their deflating their footballs, they would crank up their guns right after. God, there is nothing. It's like a tip shot of the nuts and a paintball that hits you and doesn't bust. Just two of the like most excruciating pains you could have.
Yeah, did you wear a cup when you played paintball?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, it was like, it was so banana land to me, guys that did it. And I was like, it's the same thing. Could you imagine guys that played third base and didn't wear cups or first base and didn't wear cups? What the hell, man?
I mean, I got to a point where I wore one playing soccer.
Like, the only time I felt comfortable enough, if I got stuck in the outfield, I was fine taking out my cup then.
You never know, though. I mean, as a base runner, or like, if you get a screaming, two or three hopper out there. I mean,
no, I mean, it never made sense to me. Those are the guys. So there's your paintball update for this week. All right, Cobb and I are going to start with a prompt. I want to discuss some Tiger basketball. And, whoo boy, Cobb, last night might have been Penny's like Sistine Chapel. I mean, like he might have just been in the rafters, like with the harness on, just painting the ceiling.
Well, you wouldn't know if anyone was in the rafters because they have the whole thing sealed off, you know.
That's true.
But that's not new.
Correct. But I mean, I think he played all 15 last night.
Did you see, too, where after the game, somebody asked him, do you feel any closer to settling on a rotation? And he just laughed and was like, no.
I mean, it was another starting lineup.
I told Gabe this yesterday. I want to get into the data at some point. Or maybe Parth or Munz should do this. Because this would just be me doing this so I could talk to you guys about it, really. Because at this point, well, actually, we are nearing the point with Memphis basketball where some national coverage is probably warranted, not in a very flattering light. But has any team in college basketball played more starting lineup rotations at this point in the season ever?
So this is my answer. I don't 100% know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have a spreadsheet. I find it highly unlikely that there has ever been a team that is like the only way that you would normally see these kinds of numbers is if you had like extenuating circumstances of like injuries, suspensions, whatnot. Like, but now we're at the point. That was the 12th game, right? They're 5-7, I think.
Yeah.
I believe it's 10 starting lineups in 12 games. That seems almost impossible.
Yeah, it does. It seems almost AAU or high school basketball.
But like, I think AAU team, like Herd's, I guarantee a team Thad has plays the same starting lineup more than this.
Probably, and the guys will go from playing 20 plus minutes to barely playing at all in the snap of a finger. I don't know if he's in the wrong for this, but it does make it hard to develop continuity. And I mean, you almost need an A team and a B team. They've got enough. Like you remember back in the days where, you know, your school would roster 15 or 16 players. You have an A team and a B team. We had MHEA white, MHEA blue, you know, all that. Like, and I mean, we both stunk, but at least everybody would get to play. You could figure some things out and you get a little bit more run. And
right.
You
know? But none of y'all were on scholarship.
Correct.
Like, I don't know. Cause like this is kind of the bigger picture question, which is why? Because is this just he fundamentally believes that this is their best path? Because it's not really working.
I think what it screams is there was a lack of detailed scouting in the recruiting process, because this roster was hastily assembled, thrown together, and it wasn't put together with a lot of thought. It was put together with, let's just go for best available. And
I think he's essentially admitted as much. Like, he just went for, like, he's like, I was trying, the way it happened so late in the game, I was trying to get the best players I could.
Yeah. But this is where I think staff continuity, the lack thereof, hurts. Because you should have a couple of guys on your staff who are dedicated to really drilling down deep into the tape, spending hours upon hours in synergy, spending hours upon hours talking to other coaches around college basketball who have either coached these guys or coached against them in the past. And these guys come up with really detailed self-scouts on the roster you've put together. Or better yet, they do that before you go out and offer the guy a scholarship and an NIL amount. I just don't think they did that here. Because otherwise they would have a better idea of how these pieces might fit together. They have no idea how these pieces fit together. And it's, they're not going to play another game before Christmas. They're going to go into conference play still not knowing. And that's why a large part of the reason why they are where they are is because they don't know who they are.
No, I think that's valid. I guess this is kind of the bigger picture question that I have. Why is the roster the way that it is? Because the easiest answer is, well, it's a $4 million, $4.5 million, whatever, you know, take your number, four and a half, somewhere around there, sub $5 million roster. Okay. This is kind of the bigger picture question that I have, which is this what happens when you're just kind of going bargain bin hunting, where some years maybe it comes up and it does work out, but it's not going to work out every year, and this is just one of those years that it's not going to work out? Or is this maybe trying to build the roster the same way that you would, but on a budget? Like, essentially, you know, building the same team that you would build if you had a $9, $10 million roster, but doing it with four and a half, which is just going to come up with, you know, red flag players or, you know, unproven what we're seeing. Or did he get caught flat-footed? Because I think they basically have the same amount of money that they had the previous year. The difference was everybody else was either doubling or tripling their budget. And so all of a sudden, he finds himself in a spot where he doesn't have enough money to go in with a fight.
Well, it all starts with the absence of both PJ Haggerty and Dane Danger. I would submit that even with one of those players on this team, it looks a lot different. Now, does it look like 10-3 last year when you ran through that non-conference schedule and racked up a bunch of quality victories? No, it doesn't look like that. With one of those guys and this collection of people around them, they wouldn't be sitting here at 10-2 or even 9-3, but they might be 7-5 instead.
Yeah, maybe
of five,
maybe they beat, they probably beat Wake Forest. Maybe they beat Vandy. Maybe they beat Mississippi State.
Yeah, no doubt. And at that point, we're having a totally different conversation, because that's a very reasonable outcome for a Memphis basketball.
They could have just flipped those three games without
them. They very easily could have. And so, I mean, you can argue they're not all that far off. I think in the long run, the path for this team was always going to be winning the AAC tournament. So in my mind, it's not really playing out a whole lot differently than what I expected. It just feels like there's just still so much to sort out. And the mistakes, I think, were made in this. Like, when you got Dane Danger last year, he was awesome because he was a late bloomer, wasn't a heavily recruited prospect, underutilized at his prior stops, therefore undervalued on the portal market. Aaron Bradshaw is the exact opposite of everything I just said. He was an early bloomer who was considered a five-star guy throughout his high school days, and who came from a high major program and transferred down. And Dane Danger did as well, but I mean, this guy was playing 10 minutes a game at Illinois and really with Dane,
it wasn't necessarily his performance and production put him on the bench. It was the fact that their team was better playing a different style that didn't fit him, and he found himself as odd man out.
Diamond in the rough, you could say. And honestly, you can kind of say the same for PJ Haggerty, because Memphis got a much better look at him. I think it helps. Like, I think there's a rhyme to this idea that we've seen Penny do it with Kendrick Davis and with PJ Haggerty. When you see a guy in the flesh multiple times, you scout him multiple times, you get to become intimately familiar with him. Not only that, you actually get to know the player a little bit, because you play against him, you shake his hand and maybe whisper some sweet nothings in his ear in the post-game handshake line, right? And so, but then you look at Doug McDaniel, again, he's kind of the opposite of that. And
no, Doug, I don't think it's been as up and down, but Doug has just got whiffs of Quinn Early 2.0.
Yeah, so the turnover issues are a thing there, and it's a lot of...
And in fairness to Doug, Doug is having to carry the entire load.
Yeah, it's hero ball, because
They have no one else that can run the offense.
In the half court, they don't look organized, which is not shocking when you don't have any continuity among the players on the floor. Like, you can run through things in practice and it all sounds great, but then when you put guys out there that aren't used to playing together, then they're going to struggle to execute that in the flow of a game. And so, you know, is there a chance they could get to the American and out-athlete a lot of teams and still go 14-4 in that league? Yeah, there's definitely still a chance for that. But moving forward, the recipe for success with Memphis basketball, if they aren't going to spend $8-10 million, which is, you know, probably around the average high major spending level, then you're going to need guys that really fit together. You're going to need role players in a supporting cast. So not only are Doug McDaniel and Aaron Bradshaw maybe 60% of what PJ Haggerty and Dane Danger were, but I think the role players around them are guys that used to be star players. Like Hassan Abdul-Hakim was like the guy at Rio Grande Valley. And so it's hard for a guy like that to then kind of submit to a lesser role. And so, you know, I think they tried with Curtis Givens and with Quante Berry to get your Nick Jourdain and Colby Roger types. But I don't think they really fit exactly in those roles. Like Givens is a ball dominant guard who's less experienced, whereas Colby Rogers came in with a very clearly defined role as a 3-point sniper, and he played that role to near perfection last year. You know, Tyrese Hunter was sort of your third option and your savvy secondary ball handler. And I don't think it's fair to expect Curtis Givens, who's played one season for a bad LSU team, to come in and kind of play that role, though he played well last night. So there's a lot of problems with the roster construction. And I think those problems are going to determine whether this goes down as one of Penny's worst coaching jobs or one of his best. Because if they do get it together and they win the American tournament, then we're going to call this one of his best coaching jobs. Making the NCAA tournament with this team that was started out 4-7, that had 2,500 in the stands on December 22nd versus
maybe
Alabama State. You know, I mean, if they do get it together, we'll say, wow, man, look at what Penny molded out of that group. If they don't, we're going to say it was the worst coaching job he's ever done, and rightfully so because of the roster he put together.
Well, I think that's kind of that's more of the question that I would ask of you. All right, let's say what the $4.5-5 million range. What do you think? That puts you probably, what, 50th nationally?
Yeah.
Like, there are, let's be clear, there are many coaches. I think every other coach in the league would love to have Memphis's budget. So I'm not saying that woe is me, but in terms of being a nationally relevant program, you are fighting from underneath. So if I gave you that amount of money, what do you think the best way to run the program would be?
Yeah, you got to, I think, invest more in the scouting department. And you don't have to break the bank to go and do this. You can go out. I mean, the list of programs that have general managers right now in college basketball is extensive. And it goes well beyond the high major ranks. I mean, you've got low major programs, teams in the Patriot League, teams in the Big Sky that have GMs at this point. And their jobs are, at this point, even now, to basically go in and make a hierarchy and to categorize players based on how they might fit with next year's team. And that's their sole focus. And so Memphis doesn't have that. And I think to a certain extent, Memphis needs to get on the North Carolina Hubert Davis recovery plan here. And you don't have the money to go out and hire Jim Tanner, who's one of the most successful NBA agents in the business, which is what North Carolina did. And he came to UNC because that's his school and all that. But you could go out and find somebody, a young up-and-comer in the personnel space, who can help Penny Hardaway do this. And if I'm the athletic department right now, you know, that's something I'd be looking really hard at, is somebody who can kind of hold his hand through the roster building process, somebody who can advise him on the viability, you know, of, you know, last year would have been great if you had somebody who could really come up with great contingency plans for, okay, if PJ's waiver gets denied, you know, here's what it looks like. If Dane Danger's waiver gets denied, here's what it looks like. With Haggerty, I guess it was transfer, not a waiver, but I think that's what I would do, is I would hire a GM. And you might say, well, that cuts into what we can pay the players, but I don't really buy that. I think you can go out and get a decent GM for a fraction of what you would pay for a starting guard, and then it pays for itself because he helps you put the roster together.
Okay, because that was going to be the question, because I'd asked Hurd about this. His impression was football has GMs like that in college, but his kind of impression was most of the GMs that he had met and talked to were more just like deal makers. Like, they were like the school's representative in the negotiation of the money.
Well, okay, and that's probably the case in for some schools, but for others,
the reason why I was asking, because if there are other examples exactly what we're talking about, that to me seems like it's the simplest answer.
Yeah, right. And so I can't speak to the ins and outs of what Jim Tanner does in terms of is he the given his agent background, I would assume he's more on the negotiating side than he is on the, all right, well, this guy averaged, 11.7 with such and such a splits. And, you know, here's what his tape shows. Like, I doubt Jim Tanner is on Synergy crunching tape. But, you know, I do think this is where the lack of staff continuity hurts is because you're not surrounded by people who are supporting your mission at the highest level. You're surrounded by people who are supporting your mission, but they haven't been a part of your culture. They don't know what you like and what you don't like. They're not privy to the roster building mechanisms that you prefer, right? And that lack of continuity and that lack of a clearly defined program identity, I think, is what it all comes back to. And you can fix that. Like, that's not something that is insurmountable. They need to sit down right now in a meeting room and outline what they want for the 26-27 roster and assign a couple of guys from the staff to get deep into figuring out who's out there, what their price tags might be, and how they can make that happen instead of trying to put it all together at the last minute, which is what they did for this year's team.
Yeah, and like that's also where I don't know how much criticism is fair, because on the one hand, I think they should have moved on sooner from Danger and from Haggerty, because I do agree with you. If they just had one of them, I think this is a different team. But I heard enough people that I trust that told me this Danger waiver is not happening. And I think this is where Penny's disposition, where he always just kind of believes he can get it done in terms of the deal. Like, I just felt like from the very beginning, the Haggerty situation whiffed of, this guy's going to the highest bidder. And it was very clear to me, Memphis was never going to be the highest bidder. Now, this is where I think it starts to get murky. Where I should argue, or where I could argue they should have moved on sooner, because I do think a big problem of what they have is, this to me reeks of a late-stage portal team. When you get the guys late in the portal, it looks like this. Like, the same thing with the Quinterly team. That was a bunch of guys late in the portal. And it's usually guys that are in the portal for a reason. They usually have high price tags, and you're usually not exactly getting the best.
Well,
but the place says, the reason why I don't know what's fair is the story goes that a lot of the money was tied into not just here's a blank check, and here's the money for the program. It's, well, if you can bring Haggerty back or if you can bring Dane back, I'll write the check.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder, though, if you hold on, maybe even knowing I'm not going to get them, but if we get down to the end, I can go and tell the people, hey, man, we did everything we could, but, like, we need you to – that money that you said you were going to give for them, like – give it now, because instead of going in and fighting with, a $4 million budget, they could have been gone in and fighting with a $2 million budget.
Like, yeah, that part of it is frustrating. Like, the idea that the donations may have been contingent upon specific players. Like, if you're going to give to the program, you need to have faith in the leaders of the program to do what's best with that money. Now, I also understand the desire among people around the program, donors, probably even the coaching staff, to see more continuity. You can start building that continuity now. A lot of times in both college football and college basketball, the discussions around if a guy's going to return or not are had during the season. And you can identify 3-4 guys that you want to bring back from this year's team who have eligibility remaining. I would say Curtis Givens and Julius Stedford are two prime examples of local products with eligibility remaining beyond this year, beyond next year, who you might want to go ahead and begin prioritizing now, because they could be the building blocks and the continuity that you have never had since this thing really got going or since it flipped to being portal heavy. And then you brought up an interesting point when we were talking before the show that Memphis should or maybe could or perhaps has neglected to a certain degree the international talent pool. And that's become such a source of help for the very best teams in college basketball, like Iowa State, Milan Manchilovic drilling threes, Eastern Europe. You got Dame Saar, who had a huge game for Duke the other night, coming in from the highest level of French professional basketball.
Is he related to the other one?
Olivier? I don't think so. Oh, Alex Saar. So
yeah,
Alex,
is he related to the drafted one?
Yeah, Alex and Olivier were related. I don't think Dame is related to them. I'd have to double check that. But I will say, like, you got Simon Mahawk. He was not on the radar for really anyone high major wise. And like, maybe he can be something for you. I don't know if he'll stick around or what that's going to look like, but that was just a dart into the wind at a lower level of wasn't even like full on professional ball. This guy was playing like U18 in a fairly obscure European league. And okay, like, maybe, you know, look, he is a high major player. He's got to put on 30 pounds and like figure out what goaltending is. But like, I mean, that was just your one shot in the dark at the international waters in this cycle. And it actually has probably worked out better than maybe I thought it would. Even though, you know, he's one of these guys that's played less as of late, but, that's part of it too. But you have to have that. The international game is all about relationships.
Yeah. That seems to be an entirely connections based thing. And to me, like, to your point is it's not just necessarily snapping your fingers and saying, all right, we're going international. Like, to me, the schools that seem to do it the best are the ones that get in that have connections with the national programs, and they're it essentially like functions the way that like shoe deals used to. Like, all right, well, that's a Nike guy. He's going to funnel him to a Nike school. It's like, all right, well, the Lithuanian team's got, you know, connections with said school, and like they wind up going there. Like, Randy Bennett, I think, got in with, I think that's Lithuania. Like, he always had Australia. He was early on the Australian game.
Right.
And then I think they've now got Lithuania. Like, these are more, like, obviously, if you can get in with a French one, that seems to be quite good. But it also seems like that they're placing people at higher profile spots. But,
well, you just need someone on your staff who's comfortable recruiting those waters. I talked to an agent over the offseason about the influx of international prospects into college basketball, because there's more now than we've ever seen before. And one thing he told me is that, hey, look, I'll have high major coaches turn down a really high quality prospect that I'm bringing to them because they played in the Adriatic League and they have no comfort with understanding how the Adriatic League translates to college basketball. So you need a fluency because it's overwhelming. It's daunting. If you're not familiar with the international leagues, there's 10 or 12 of them that are producing college level players right now. But if you don't have the tools or the experience to decipher what's what over there, that can be daunting. It can be like being a young college football coach who's only ever recruited the West Coast. And then all of a sudden you take a job in the SEC and you're trying to recruit the state of Georgia and you don't know.
Harsin.
You know, right. Like, you don't know the difference between Warner Robins and Macon and what's good and what's not. Right. And so like, the geographical connections, it doesn't necessarily have to be an international coach. Like, you don't have to go get a Lithuanian coach or a coach who's been in the Adriatic League. I'm not saying that, but you need somebody who's recruited those waters and has relationships with the agents who represent those guys. And so that's a piece of it too. The structure, there has to be a structure to your roster construction here. Like, there has to be a, you know, guys who, all right, you're elite, running point on scouting the portal. You're running point on scouting international. You're running point on scouting high school. And then you need to have all of those guys to a certain extent be dialed in with your current roster to gauge the feasibility of getting some guys to come back. And it just feels like when you have that constant churn on the staff and you have that constant churn within your roster, like, some of those things are missing.
No, and I think that's kind of what it all boils down to, which is the fundamental question of, like, any of the ideas that we have, you tell me if you think I'm wrong. Doesn't it feel like these are long shots to happen with Penny?
Yeah, I mean, he does it his way.
And I think, to me, like, that would be the biggest argument that I would make is that I think usually – the biggest enemy of Coach Penny has consistently been GM Penny. And this is why I think the most significant conversation that Ed Scott and Penny need to have, I think they got to figure out a way to get somebody. And hey, there's no GM that takes wins and losses. I understand that. And Penny doesn't mean Penny can't have final say, but it does feel like they have got to get some type of GM in the program that is going to put the pieces on the whiteboard, if you will, together.
Yeah, well, GM Penny was perfectly suited for pre-NIL. Perfectly suited. He's Penny Hardaway. He's coaching at a program with a lot of street credibility from the John Calipari and Josh Pastner eras, where they recruited at a really high level. It was all about high school talent. Everybody had the same sort of hand in terms of finances. It was, you know, under the table or whatever, and they could play that game as well as anybody. And so GM Penny in those days was great. Look at the talent he brought in.
Well, to your other point, when you're recruiting those players, he's seen them all. Because I do think you're right. I think, weirdly, the other structure that I think worked for him was the AAC All-Stars. Because if Penny gets his eyes on guys, I think he's pretty good at going, that guy can play. I don't necessarily trust when Penny's just watching film and tape of, like, you know, and I'm not saying I would love to know what everybody's batting average is of just grinding the old tape, if you will. But it seemed to me he was at his best when he could get eyes on them. And to your point, like when he's been running Team Penny and he's seen all these guys for 4 or 5 years, he had a pretty good sense of who could play and who couldn't.
And when he had a level playing field, him being Penny was going to help him win those battles. He doesn't have a level playing field anymore. We put him at 50, you know, in terms of roster spending. Could be 75, right? And you're not going to get the, hey, I'm Penny Hardaway discount. When you're getting offered 1.5 mil over here, you ain't going to take 600 just to play for Penny Hardaway. And that's change. And that change, I think, requires him to adapt in maybe ways that he hasn't at this point. Because is Penny Hardaway the coach enough of a masterful tactician and schematic wizard to overcome a talent deficiency? I don't necessarily buy that. But you have to be. If you want to be nationally relevant, ranked in the top 25 and get a 5 seed year in, year out in the NCAA tournament.
If you go back to your system point, I think Penny's answer would be this is his system. It's the pressing. It's the playing guy. Like, I think what he would tell you is that's the doing it a different way that is the system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never loved this as a system. Like, I know we can always point to, like, Huggy Bear press the whole game, but it's like, I don't know, man. Like, it does not seem to me. I think if this were a more effective way to close the talent gap, like, to me, this is not like the spread offense. You know, like, when originally teams were running tempo and spreading the field to try and make up for the fact that they didn't have as many bodies in the middle that the Alabamas and the Georgias of the world did. How many other teams are essentially doing this?
Well, if you have better players, you can kill people doing it. If you have better players than they do. If you don't, then you're going to end up in a close game. And at the end of that close game, you're going to need somebody who in the flow of a half court set can get a clean look and not. And now in those situations, it's a lot of Doug McDaniel ISO and it's ugly. You don't really have anybody who can dump the ball down to on the block like you did last year with Dane Danger to go get you a bucket or draw a double team. Aaron Bradshaw is not that player. That's never been his style of play. So it's having gone through all these issues, though, there is still a path here because, like, they're only scratching the surface of, like, what they'll be as a finished product if they ever get there.
I do agree with the point that you made earlier. I don't think they suck. Like,
they could have won 5 of these games. 5 of these
correct.
Games were very winnable.
I don't think they suck, but I also think my eyes tell me this team could go 12-6 in the league.
Yeah, that would be less than ideal. So a couple of small things they could fix without having to make any drastic.
Maybe play 8 guys?
Yeah, trim down the rotation and just tighten things up on defense. Like, you watch the Louisville game, I mean, they were just so – they were just exposed defensively in that game against a highly skilled opponent. If they buttoned up
I can't believe I'm going to do this. I'll kind of take up for them in that game. I thought their defense was okay until, like, the last 5 minutes of the first half, and then Louisville kind of barraged them, and then it felt like it was a lot of – they were trying to hit 30-point shots. Like, it felt like it got it continued to spiral and get away because it felt like they abandoned everything and then went to, like, we've got to get back into it.
Yeah. I might draw the rotation line. I mean, if we get it down to 10, 9 or 10 guys right now, that would be a step in the right direction because you do. If
maybe
you're gonna play,
two consecutive games with the same starting lineup?
Maybe. Just give
two,
it a shot.
Start with two. Like, I want to ask for three, but it's like, that feels greedy.
Well, if you're going to crash as hard as they crash and you're going to press as much as they press, drawing that line at 8 is tough because you got to keep that intensity.
Oh, no,
up.
I'm hoping that by playing 8, he'll stop. By the way, is anyone else – am I missing something? He acts like this press is, like, the greatest press in the history of the world, that it's like, you know, he is viewing this press the same way Todd Grantham believes in a blitz. Like, they don't believe that there are answers for it.
Well, again, it depends on the opponent. You know, some opponents can handle it, some of them can't. If you're up against one that can, like, you got to have a changeup or a curveball to throw, you know, and they don't really have that defensively. It's, we're going to try to fluster you, turn you over, and use that to get easy buckets. And it's a lot, you know, it's really tough on those nights when everything's going down for the opponent to have to take the ball out of the basket, and then you got to play in the half court, you know, and that's not what they're good at. So you got to have a different look you can throw at teams.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk college football playoff. Let's recap the weekend, some of the best and worst that we saw from the college football playoff. We'll talk about it next right here on Jeff Wright and Company, 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.
All right, Cobb, we're through the first round of the college football playoff. Let's talk about what we saw this weekend. Who did you think had the most impressive win?
Well, most impressive win would be either Alabama or Miami. Most impressive team, I would give that award to Ole Miss, a team that lost its head coach, that had to go through everything they went through, and then still came out and played the way they played. The most impressive team was Ole Miss. It wasn't the most impressive victory because of the caliber of opponent, but they were the most impressive team.
They looked like Ole Miss.
Exactly right. No Lane Kiffin, no problem. It kind of lended some credence to what Pete Golding has been saying, which is like, hey, man, at this point in the year, they don't care who leads them out of the tunnel. Which, by the way, I know you were there, so you probably didn't notice on the broadcast. But it was funny, like, you could tell Pete Golding had never led a team out of the tunnel before because he did this little motion like, let's go, but the players didn't see it. So then he just started running, and then they followed him. It was just pretty incredible to see them back up everything he's been saying. Now, I'm not projecting anything moving forward. We can, you know.
No, because I agree with you in terms of – I'm not even saying it was a negative. We did not know what they were going to look like. That didn't necessarily mean it was going to, therefore, like, that's the problem. When you sit there and say, like, I don't know what they're going to look like, sometimes people just immediately take that as a negative. No, it's like, I simply don't know. We have no data to suggest that one way or the other. We did not know, and they looked like Ole Miss. Now, where I do think they're going to miss Lane the next game, I did think on third downs when they get the whistle plays where Kiffin like just uses that loud whistle to get his fake dog. It's a real dog. It just doesn't belong to him.
You see, there's a Twitter account now for the dog called Juice Golding.
Yeah, that's that was the other thing. I thought on third downs they were not as good, and I think a lot of times third downs are when Lane would do the whistle and then he would, you know, essentially change the play to he sees the coverage, he knows what to call, and they would run that. I think they're going to miss that a little bit, but in terms of the way that they came out, like their scripted drives look pretty good. Like they looked like Ole Miss. And so I think they answered that for the most part.
I think most impressive win is a different question. And to me, that would be Miami going on the road and beating Texas A&M. So because of who Oklahoma is, I would give Miami a slight edge. Cause like, yeah, okay, Alabama was, you know, that's an impressive win going on the road. Same deal. Beating a team that already beat you this season, like being down 17-0, like all that. But like, okay, if you just asked me straight up before the playoff started, what would be more impressive, Miami winning at Texas A&M or Alabama winning at Oklahoma? I think I would have said Miami at A&M. And Mark Fletcher Jr. and that defense, they were top-notch.
I didn't know what to make of that game.
Well, I mean, so neither of those games, they were great entertainment, but they were bad football. Like there wasn't great football played in those games.
Certainly wasn't great offense played.
I mean, the wind was insane.
That was the problem, that I didn't know what to make of it, because neither quarterback looked good. But where I give Beck credit, that was a game where Beck historically tries to force the issue, and he really didn't. You know what I mean? Like, he was ultra conservative, but like, it was a tough day to throw, and he didn't really put the ball in harm's way. And you can't say the same for Marcel Reed.
Well, his Beck's touchdown pass, if you want to call it that, was a 6-inch forward flip.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cheater.
It was a run play.
It's a cheater pass.
A stat patter. You know, without that, he doesn't even have 100 yards passing. But you're right, he did turn the football over. I mean, you got to give him credit for that. So that was a. Okay, so I thought probably the most interesting storyline, or one of the more interesting, maybe most overlooked storyline from the first round, is how Alabama and Miami winning kept the Notre Dame being snubbed story from getting more oxygen.
Well, because it was funny, the other narrative that I thought about the Miami A&M game was, fairly or not, whoever lost the game was going to be a fraud. Their whole like that was just going to be a fraud indictment bowl,
and it comes back to the point I make about, had either one of those teams lost, the Notre Dame furor would have reignited and gone to even greater levels, because I mean the way Alabama looked in the first half of that game, first, you know, quarter and a half anyway, it was like, oh wow, I cannot believe. I mean, I texted one of my Notre Dame buddies and was like, hey, I'm so sorry that like your team got left out for this piece of hot garbage. And then lo and behold, Xavier Brown and Oklahoma's numerous blunders happen, and so it completely changed that narrative. And it was, I mean, for Mario Cristobal and for Kalen DeBoer, like, it just making the playoff isn't the standard anymore for some of these programs, especially for Alabama, for Kalen DeBoer, where you're succeeding Nick Saban. And it feels like, to me, still, it's like, you got to at least get to the semifinals to
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was wondering, and maybe we should ask Drew this, but if they go and like, let's say they lose to Indiana, like what, the spread 6.5, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they lose to Indiana 24-17. Is this a good year?
It feels like this Alabama team is getting the most out of what it is. It doesn't feel like there's another level for this team.
Because that was the other thing that I was saying. Because like, when we were thinking about most impressive win, if you tell me Alabama was down 17-0 and came back and won, I weirdly would have said, well, that had to be the most impressive win. But the reason why I think that you might be right with Miami is, the thing that was so interesting about watching Bama go down 17-0 was how casual the comeback felt. And this is not, to your point, we saw Saban teams fall behind, but inevitably, like, the longer the game went on, those teams would inevitably just come back, because they usually had so much talent. The more plays that were run, they would eventually get stops, and then you couldn't do anything about it. Under DeBoer, it's typically been kind of a front-running team. Like, if you think back to their biggest wins, it's usually jumping up on Georgia and putting a number up, and Georgia can't come get them. We haven't really seen them have the come from behind. And, I mean, it wasn't just they were down 17-0. Cobb, weren't they down 17-0 without a first down?
Yeah, it was bleak because they can't run the football. And that's where that passing game being off track just wrecked them. The margin for error with Alabama, I've never seen it smaller. I mean, since Nick Saban, I mean, okay, you could say his first year, but since Nick Saban's first year, I've never seen an Alabama team that has to thread the needle the way this team does. And it's a 30-yard, you know, air yard out route on a 3rd and 9. That's got to be on the money for them to keep a drive going. And if they don't complete it, well, then they're going to punt the football back, and their defense isn't what it used to be, and they might give up 7. Like, the margin for error is tiny, and the fact that they've managed to reach the quarterfinals of the college football playoff with a team that doesn't have the inherent talent advantages of the past Alabama teams, I don't know that Nick Saban would have done as good of a job with this team as Kalen DeBoer has.
No, because I also believe part of Nick getting out is Nick knew that he couldn't just talent it anymore.
He knew he didn't have the talent advantage anymore.
Because Topmeyer and I workshopped this theory. I actually weirdly think Nick's best coaching job was kind of that last team. And that's mainly a reflection of, I think, so little of Milroe as a leader and a quarterback. The fact that he basically got that team to one play away from a national championship is unbelievable. But Topmeyer and I's theory is that Bryce Young and Will Anderson papered over a lot of what you're now seeing. It's not like Alabama's roster's bad. There's plenty of good football players on that team. But it's not like the 50 guys on this roster are going to be in the NFL.
Yeah, they are what they are, which is a team with a lot of talented receivers and pass catchers and a secondary that comes up with clutch plays. But
I also thought, I'd give Kane Womack credit. They took that barrage from Oklahoma. But really, after it, like that second quarter, when he started to kind of figure out, okay, here's where Mateer was trying to take advantage. Like, he clearly figured out some twists and stunts that worked against their offensive line, and they started to really pressure him. But, like, they really turned the water. Other than that one touchdown drive in the second half, like, I did not have any confidence that Oklahoma was going to move the ball at all.
Yeah. The Alabama defense, though, it's not vintage.
No. I mean, is there one guy that – they have good players. But is there a guy that you're like, oh, my God?
Well, don't throw anywhere Keon Saab late in the first half. I'll say that.
That's probably true.
Or Xavier Brown, I mean.
Maybe it's up front that it feels like they don't have a dude.
Right. Like, where's your first-team All-American edge rusher who's going to be a first-round draft
pick? Yeah, like, where's the guy that you just sit there and you're like, how do you block him? Like, I felt like Oklahoma had those guys.
Well, that Oklahoma defense kind of got exposed a little bit. I mean, it wasn't like Alabama put up 500 yards on them, but when push came to shove and those guys, Alabama receivers ended up in one-on-one coverage, like, they won those battles. And part of that is due to an inconsistent pass rush. Like, to me, the biggest problem with Ty Simpson and the thing that worries me the most about Alabama against Indiana is just how nervous he looks in the pocket. Like, there are times where, one, either he doesn't see the blitz, like, he's sitting back there happy in the pocket, getting ready to throw the ball, has no idea the blitz is coming. Or there's really not a lot of pressure, yet he's all jumpy back there. He ends up throwing off an imbalanced platform, you know, and throwing behind a guy or whatever. He just never looks comfortable to me in the pocket, which is a problem when you're going up against that Indiana defense. Now,
I definitely think there's a lack of trust in his offensive line.
Yeah.
I do think some of what you're describing is he doesn't know if it's going to get blocked up. Because I do agree with you on that. I also wonder how much of it is like a healthy fear of Oklahoma's front. Mm-hmm. Because I think you know that those guys are like at any given second away from breaking free. I thought, though, for the most part, I thought he settled down and played really well. Like, the thing that was confusing about Alabama's receivers on Saturday was they would make these grabs on the tough catch. that was like, it felt like a, there had like four or five different catches that could have been number one on top plays. And then like when they would just have a hitch route with nobody around him, they just drop it. I was like, how do those two things happen?
But Bernard almost went full on Tyrone Pro throw yeah. with that over the helmet catch. Lottie Brooks, man, true freshman out there making plays and getting in the end zone. And then
it is also, I mean, doesn't he wear seven also?
Does he? Yeah.
I'm always then, confused when I see seven Brooks. I'm like, wait, that guy's back?
Yeah, right. So that, I mean, his emergence was huge. And then Isaiah Horton. I mean, that guy. Brooks is 17.
17. Okay. Yeah, you can't wear seven in Brooks again. Like, we can't have repeat last name, same number. We can't have that. All right.
Nah.
My most outstanding play of the weekend. I don't know if TV caught this, but George and I watched what I think is still the greatest flag throw in the history of officiating flag throws. It was in the third quarter. There was a pass interference, like, right on the home sideline, and the back judge is, like, 30 yards behind the play, and just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you just see this missile coming in from, like, 30 yards out and lands, like, basically right next to where the play was. I've never seen an official throw a flag that impressively. It was the best throw of the game by far.
That's why you go to games. You yes. can't see that on the broadcast.
Well, it's that, and then I was completely dumbfounded. Tulane's backup punter is one of the most impressive punters I've ever seen. This guy was just hitting moon balls. Like, he was hitting balls that would go over the press box, but he wasn't their normal punter. They do like everyone. They have an Australian punter. And have we jumped the shark? Do we have too many Australian punters out there? Like, this guy was just hitting absolute moonballs, like, to the point where at halftime, like, I made my wife and my brothers, I was like, y'all have to watch this guy. And they're looking at me like I'm a crazy person. Like, that. But I was just fixated. This guy, it was their backup punter. He only hit one kick that counted, and unbelievable. Like, I have no idea. Someone should go get that guy out of the portal.
How long until we get an Australian Shohei? Because all we hear about is these Australian punters and they played rugby, so they know how to rugby style it. Okay, great. If you played rugby, you should also be able to run the football too. So, like, how long before we get somebody who can do both? Who can play fullback?
Well, Brad Wing.
Yeah.
I mean, Brad Wing. Remember he had the long run for LSU and then got the taunting penalty.
Yeah. So I got to know, what was it like being there? As you know, you have like long family ties to Ole Miss, and George, like, I know you're a big Ole Miss guy. Like, I permit you all here for a moment to indulge the fan side of who you are. Cause I want to know,
I'm telling
like,
you,
what did it feel like to be at Ole Miss for that game?
I was just mainly impressed because my wife was like asking me, she's like, does this not like get your juices going again? Like, you remember when you did root for him? I was like, too much history has happened, and like, that's just, it's something that's gone. But like, I was happy. Like, that meant a lot to my dad, and I was happy for my dad. It meant a lot to my brothers. It meant a lot to my wife, and I was very, very happy for them that they got that moment. But in terms of an atmosphere, I just, the whole time I was just blown away. I was like, I told the story that on the 4th-and-25 play where Hunter Henry threw it back to Alex Collins and they kept Ole Miss from winning the West that year, I was on the, because you know, that was at the overtime. So, you know, media, you go down to the field for like whatever the last 5 minutes. And I was having a conversation with my boss and my coworker during that play, like, and we were just talking to each other. And this weekend, there were multiple moments where I was like, man, it's loud here. And the only other time I could think of it being that loud, it wasn't even the 2014 when they beat Alabama. It was 2003 when LSU came to town and it was winner wins the West. The first or second play of the game, Ole Miss picks it off and runs it all the way back and they're up 7-0. The stadium shook. Mm-hmm. This was the most impressive I've ever seen in terms of they got everybody there early. I mean, I'm talking, George, band went on the field 30 minutes before. Stadium was full.
Yeah, usually. So pregame typically starts like 20, I think it's 23.
Yeah.
Pre-kickoff and not an empty seat.
And for the most part,
echo to the whistle.
Nobody left until well after the clock said triple zeros.
They did an awesome job. The broadcast did a pretty good job of showing the scene, and they had a ton of panoramic stadium shots, ton of crowds.
There was a single engine plane that I think was that camera.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You've built a killer sports podcast. You bring the heat every week, and you have a loyal audience. But when it comes to monetizing, you're still leaving too much on the table. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on delivering the play-by-play and hot takes, and our experienced sales team goes to work bringing in ad dollars. Let's turn those downloads into revenue. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start making money from your podcast.